Today I want to give examples of how geometry can work in a different way in string theory. So in the previous, at the end of last week, we saw that, well, string theory at low energy behaves like a theory of gravity. There is a space-time with a fluctuating metric and all of that. And the big assumption was that I could use perturbation theory on the worksheet, perturbation theory in alpha prime. And this was pretty much a derivative expansion in a sense. Like I have the beta function, I'm looking at terms that don't have too many derivatives, not have too many weak contractions. So to see where these ideas go wrong, I should look at situations where this sort of perturbation theory breaks down. So if before I was thinking about space-times, which are nice and almost flat, and had some small fluctuations of the metric on top of that, I should look at space-times which do not look like flat space, flat 26-dimensional space-time. And the simplest example that I can still exactly solve and do calculations with is a space-time of the form R 1,24, or 24,1, times S1. So I take a space which is flat space in 25 directions, but I compactify one of the directions of space. So let's do closure Klein reduction of string theory. If the discussion from last time applied to this situation, then I would predict that I'm going to find the closure Klein reduction of a theory of gravity. Right? So out of the metric in 26 directions, I'll find something which has, let's see, what happens actually. Let's talk about that for a second before we continue. So what happens if I have gravity on S1 times flat space? So literal closure Klein. What do you know about this? Have you ever seen something like that? How would I study this problem? First of all, suppose I live in this universe and I'm big compared to the size of this circle. What do I see?
I don't see the circle.
Why?
Because sort of momentum excitations in the direction of the circle. I'm too big to go in the direction, basically, right? That's the statement.
Why can't I just move a little bit and then become invisible? I don't know.
Because
there are quantiles. Yeah, that's right. Because the momentum in the transverse direction is quantized. It costs a lot of energy to get momentum in transverse direction, to move in the transverse direction. So my sort of e to the I pi IT x waves become an e to the I p theta, you know, I n theta, where theta is the angle around the circle. And so the momentum is quantized in units of the radius, which, so if I have a scalar field in this space-time, it will look like a scalar field in one dimension lower. It will look like a tower of scalar fields in one dimension lower, but one of them will have sort of the original mass, and the other ones will effectively have a much bigger mass of order 1 over r squared. But what if my field has indices? What if I have a metric? What happens?
Look like tensors with less
indices. That's right. So I have the metric in d minus 1 dimensions, but I also get a metric with a leg around the circle, and also a metric with two legs around the circle. This is a scalar field which controls the radius. It's called the radian. And this one is actually a gauge field, a U1 gauge field. It sort of controls how this circle can be farther in a non-trivial way over my space-time. For example, the field strength of this tells me how much the circle rotates if I take a walk in space-time. And so the original Kosa-Klein idea was to see electromagnetism as coming from a five-dimensional space-time. Problem is, we don't see the radian. Now, what let's see what happens to string theory now. So to do that, I need to study a very special scalar field, which is periodic. What are the possible consequences of that? Suppose I want to study, really, even classically, that kind of field on a cylinder. So sigma, as before, tau. And I want to study that scalar field over there. What are the states of this system? Remember the questions of motion. The question of motion are still the same, okay? The sigma squared plus the tau squared. X equal to 0.
Mm-hmm. So now I have like different boundary conditions, right? I'm not going to have periodic boundary conditions, but I'm going to have a periodic up to some multiple of 2 pi r, basically.
Right, you're saying that there is new solutions that I didn't have before, where I can put a constant times sigma. Not any constant, really, and r. The W, let me call it WR, sigma. Because as sigma goes to sigma plus 2 pi, x will go to x plus 2 pi WR. And if W is an integer, that's fine. So these are sort of classical solutions, time-independent classical solutions. And it's kind of reasonable to expect that I can do a quantization around any of these solutions. So instead of getting the Hilbert space out of quantizing around the x equal to 0 solution, now I can get a whole, you know, a direct sum of sectors in which my classical solution has some winding. The way you do it is do the usual expansion. So this I should probably call r theta, maybe. Let me just call it little x, but we had to remember some interesting things. So there is the usual mode expansion with A's and A bars, just as before. There are the usual zero modes, X and P. But now X is compact. And so P is quantized. So So now we have ground states, which are labeled by N and W. And then we build out of them. A Fock space. And you can compute sort of L0 and L0 bar acting on this one, on these states. You get something like 1/2 N over R minus RW over 2 squared and 1/2 N over R plus RW over 2 squared. Now, as a sanity check, the difference between L0 and L0 bar is NW. So this is an important sanity check because the spin, the quantum number under rotations of the circle, has to be an integer. This corresponds to sort of the sigma, the quantization of the sigma rotations. And so it's an integer, that's good. And the energies are a bit weirder. Okay. So the first thing I could say is, well, I can build interesting string states now. What was before the tachyon, I can build out of something like this. Here I'm referring to the remaining directions. Then I can act with modes. I can have both modes here and here, of course. I could do something like that. Many options. Many options, and some of these options are really weird. Like here. When can I use this? What are the conditions for a state to be physical?
It has to be annihilated by the Allens.
Sure. As a primary, this is a primary. It also has to have L0 equal to L0 bar equal to 1. Now, L0 equal to L0 bar tells me that either N is 0 or W is 0. So I should really do this. And then if either of the two is 0, I get now some reasonable conditions. Something like p squared plus n squared over 2r squared equal to 2 for these states. And here, something like p squared plus m squared over 8r squared equal to 2. Okay. So this looks familiar. These are sort of Kaluza-Klein modes for the tachyon. They are standard tachyons. They have momentum, quantized momentum in the circle direction. These were definitely expected. But what about these? Notice they have a very large mass if the radius is large. But as the large becomes smaller and smaller, well, they start competing with your Kaluza-Klein modes. If the radius gets smaller than 1, these are much lighter than your Kaluza-Klein modes. So something is going very weird. with the geometry. Actually, there is a, it turns out there is a perfect symmetry between N and W. So I will elaborate on this. But this theory, the Sarkol-valued scalar field, has a curious property that if you invert the radius, and now I need to invert it the right way, I think it's 2 over R, yeah, and also invert these quantum numbers, nothing changes. So if I study my string theory on a circle, this gets smaller and smaller, much smaller than one. At some point, I get a tower of new states, which come out of nowhere, come out from strings wrapping the circle. And they start behaving like Kaluza-Klein modes in a dual circle. And by the time I get to r equal to 0, I find myself again in 26 dimensions. So this is called t-duality. Now we can keep looking at what happens to other modes, for example, the graviton and so on. But for now, let's look at this. This is also an interesting state. So this state has a raising operator on the holomorphic side, but not on the anti-holomorphic side. So L0 is 1 greater than L0 bar. But on the other hand, so this can only work if L0 bar minus L0 of the ground state is 1. So we can make it work for N equal to 1 and W equal to 1. So this is also fine. And it has a bizarre energy of, so I want N over 1 over R minus R over 2 squared. Okay, so like P squared plus 1 over 1 half, 1 over R minus R over 2 squared equal to 2. But it's not a momentum like this. It's not a, it's just another completely new state. So you just get new stuff as soon as the radius gets sufficiently small. These particular elements give you a gauge field, but you get two of them because you can do both A minus 1, A minus 1 bar. But actually, that's not as surprising as it sounds, because I also use the B field. So out of that, I can get. But what's interesting is that if you look at this tower of states, so usually in the Kaluza-Klein reduction, the things that are things with Kaluza-Klein momentum are charged under this gauge field. Now the things are charged under this gauge field, but the things that have W are charged under this field. Now this actually agrees with sort of the interpretation we're giving at some point of the B field. We're seeing the B field is something that couples to my string worksheet. Well, if the string worksheet is wrapping a circle, then I'm going to pick up this component of B. So states with winding, you know, strings that are wrapped in the circle have a chance to be charged under the gauge field that comes out of B. And indeed they are. So you can study a scattering amplitude of one of these modes of these states and verify that indeed states with winding carry charge under the reduction of the B field. this is a way to support the idea that this was really the field that couples to the string worksheet. Anyway, perhaps not so important. So, how do we see, how do we understand this symmetry, this duality a bit better? So, there are different ways, but one way is to say that there is a new field which has the property that the holomorphic derivatives are the same as the old field, and the anti-holomorphic derivatives are opposite. So if you do this transformation, you end up flipping some signs all around. And you end up exchanging the role of P and sigma in this expansion. Now, some aspects of t-duality perhaps I should discuss is the state operator map. So how would I do calculations in this theory? So we said there is a bunch of new states. How would I compute scattering amplitudes? So I need a state operator map. So where do I send a state like this? To which operator do I send this? So we need to be very careful here because, we are going to discover something we should have known, that there are many ways to do operators in quantum field theory, not just polynomials in the fields. See, this operator must have a very weird property. So this state was defined in such a way that if I put the state with a certain number of winding, and I take x or sigma, and I carry it all around, I find the old x plus 2 pi w r. So if I sort of map this picture to the plane with a state operator map, I discover that if I put this operator O and w at the origin, and I carry x around the other operator, is going to go to x of z plus 2 pi r w. So the original field is not single valued around this, which, you know, it's fine, it's not a dramatic problem. But so part of the point is that somehow x itself is not observable anymore because x is not single valued. The things I can observe are periodic functions of x. So something I could observe is, say, e to the I n over r x. This is perfectly single valued in the presence of this operator, because as I carry it around, this just by e to the 2 pi I times an integral. So if I want to do calculations in the presence of this operator, I need to do path integral over fields which have this periodicity property. So this is what's called the disorder operator. It's an operator, local operator, that I define by changing the path integral, by saying, OK, I'm going to integrate over field configurations which have a certain singularity, a certain topologically non-trivial behavior around this location. I excise this location from my worksheet, and I do a path integral over x away from this location. Now, in general, computing the correlation function of disordered operators can be difficult. For example, if you ever wanted to study a situation where you have a disordered operator which sends x to minus x, that requires work. But these particular disordered operators are sort of easier to work with. The reason they are easier to work with is actually sort of a bit deep, is that these operators behave well when I bring the z to them, the x to them. So just using that expansion, you can verify what happens if I bring dx to one of these operators using the state proper map. And you get something like n over r minus wr over 2 over z of n mw. And here you get this n over r plus wr over 2. I'm probably forgetting some factors of I. Let's not worry about that. So correlation functions of dx in the presence of a bunch of these operators are still pretty simple. They behave much like the vertex operators, except that give me slightly different poles to del x and del bar x. And then using the fact that, using some conformal perturbation, so just a bit of OPEs and conformal field theory, you can derive sort of equations that constrain the correlation function of these operators. That's one way you could do the calculation. Or you can just accept the idea that you need to do a path integral like that. It's not too difficult. It's not too difficult because this sort of this non-locality is additive. Meaning, if I have a correlation function and I've placed a bunch of these operators, I can write a classical solution, which is just a sum of logarithms. And then it's a Gaussian path integral. So to compute it, you can always shift x by the classical solution, do the start, and then the linear terms will drop out. And the answer is going to be pretty much e to the classical action times the standard answer. And so you can compute the classical action for this, a little bit of care with regularization and renormalization and whatnot. Yes?
Are there some factors of W in front of the logs? Or?
Yes. So here there are some numbers which are pretty much these numbers. And so at the end, after the dust settles, your correlation function of the product of over I of O and I, WI of ZI, z bar I, is a small generalization of what we know for vertex operators. So it's a product over I smaller than j, zi minus zj to the something like that, and I over r minus mi r over 2, and j over r minus mj r over 2. And then the same thing for the anti-holomorphic. Something like that. And although it doesn't look like it, because I have fractional powers of z's and z bars, this expression is actually single valued, pretty much because of that. So this exponent minus this exponent is an integer. So effectively, I have some polynomial in z's times absolute value of zz bars to some fractional powers. And so using this expression and similar modifications, you can easily compute any scattering up, three-level scattering up that you want involving these states.
So now,
yes?
Can you explain again? It's because I think I didn't understand.
Mm-hmm.
What is the classical solution to what? Like, we are...
I'm saying, suppose I want to compute a correlation function, this correlation function with a path integral. Right? But only the condition that x is multivalued. You can rewrite this as a path integral over a single valued. X e to the s of some x classical plus x, where x classical is this multivalued solution. And then because this is a solution and this is a Gaussian integral, this is the same as S class S of X classical plus S of X. This is the same strategy you could use to compute a product of e to the ipx before. We're just adjusting it a little bit to include this multivaluedness. So if you remember the exponential vertex operators before we're giving sources to x. Now these operators give you both source and multivaluedness, but together they just give you a sum of a log and a log. And so the calculation is just very similar to the one for standard vertex operators. And indeed, sometimes people write these operators formally as e to the I sort of n over r minus mw over 2, sort of an holomorphic version, an holomorphic part of x plus n over r plus mw over 2, an anti-holomorphic part of x. Now, this doesn't really make sense. X is not a sum of an holomorphic and anti-holomorphic field. But if you pretend it is true, you can get almost all of the answers correct. Add to some subtleties. There are some subtle signs that can get you confused when you do calculations with these operators. So you can ask, what's the OP of O and M and W? O of n prime, w prime. And you sort of want to say that there is some power of z minus z prime and z bar minus z prime prime bar times O of n plus n prime, w plus w prime. It's almost true, but because now you have this integer. So it's not an absolute value of z minus z bar squared anymore. So it kind of matters if you put z or z prime first, if you're not careful. So you need to sort of include some special signs that take care of this. There are some. There's also choices you need to make to write down OPEs, and the choices you make might be different from the choices I make, and they're related by a signed redefinition of all of your operators. So in a sense, you can write down OPEs, but it's difficult to write down OPEs in a way that is manifestly duality invariant. There are some choices which need to be played around with. Not a big deal, but it's a thing. It's vaguely related to things that happen in four dimensions. So you try to talk about Tuft-Wilson lines. So a little bit of a warning, there are some interesting Tuft anomalies here that one can spend some time on. So this theory has two U1 symmetries, one whose charge is N, the other whose charge is W. Kaluza-Klein momentum and winding. And there is also a T-duality that wants to exchange them. But there are some complicated mixed anomalies. So this is a kind of a cute example of all sort of condensed matter physics phenomena. Another interesting phenomenon that happens that is relevant to condensed matter physics is that the scaling dimension suppose that you have a system and you believe that at low energy gives you a circle value scalar. Okay. Now it's very often the case that one of these U1 symmetries, so because there are these mixed anomalies between all of these three factors, you cannot write a lattice system easily which has both these symmetries acting on it. You can if you make your symmetries act in a non-local way. There's a whole story there. But otherwise, your typical lattice system, you will have, say, one of the symmetries manifest and the other not manifest, emergent. So now what happens is that if you try to find out the low energy effective action of your system, you might encounter these operators in the action. I mean, if you have a U1 symmetry, like if you have a U1n symmetry, you cannot have momentum in the local operators you add to the action, effective action, because they would break the symmetry. But you could have your sort of naive action plus these operators. Let me just take care of the first one. Now, what's the scaling dimension of this operator? I can read it from here. It's r squared over 8. So if the radius of the circle you find at low energy is greater than 2 square root of 2, this is irrelevant. And so you can have it in your effective action. It just does nothing at low energy. But if the radius is shorter than 2 square root of 2, then it's relevant, and it will do stuff. What does it do? Well, at first sight is very hard to see. But you can use T-duality to see what it does. Map it to O1, 0, which is just e to the I x. Y, let me call this dual scalar. So there is this beautiful physics that I'm really cutting very short, that you have phase diagrams where there is some parameter in the UV which becomes a radius in the infrared, the radius of your circle. And when this is bigger than some value, you find an S1 value scalar. But if it's smaller, you will typically have this irrelevant relevant deformation turned on. You have no control on it. And in the dual picture, this turns out some kind of a potential, something like that, because it's like a sine or a cosine. And so you get a vacuum, a single vacuum. And so this is gapped. So this is called the Kosterlitz-Tauless transition in 2D CFTs, in condensed matter physics. You can have systems which have a continuous line of phase transitions, which at some point it ends. And if you study what's happening, is you see that there is an operator which Voskalin mentioned is going down until it hits one, and then destabilizes the system. And what's interesting is that because this is a family of CFTs, you have the scaling dimension of things vary in it along this line. So this is actually very rare. It's very rare to find a situation without supersymmetry where you have a continuous family of conformal field theories, a continuous family of critical points. Typically, in phase diagrams, you have phases, and in each phase, well, you might be gapped, or if you're gapless, you're probably a CFT. And if you have a CFT, you have specific scaling dimensions, you're a specific CFT. And you're a specific CFT on the whole region until maybe there is different phase transition. So the typical picture you have some phase diagram, you have some regions that are gapped, and then maybe if you're lucky, you might find a whole line that is gapless. Like if you have a line of second order phase transitions, but along the whole line, you have some CFT. Same CFT. And then at a special point along the line, you might find some other CFT. But here we have a very special situation where instead you have whole families of CFT. And then which ends at a special point where you have just one of the members in that family, a special member of that family. So this can only happen if you have families of CFTs. And I was saying, in non-supersymmetric situation, the self-dual boson, the compact boson, or multiple compact bosons, are pretty much the only possible examples of families of CFTs. Because in order to be a family of CFTs, you need to have a local operator of dimension exactly 1, comma 1. And that's exceptional. There is no reason for that to happen. The scaling dimensions of operators in a CFT are just random numbers. Well, maybe not random, but definitely not integers. But you know the theory, the CFT, this happens in experiments. This is a costly starless transition. Only in 1+1 dimension, because in dimension greater than 2, we don't know any CFT which has a continuous family of deformations except supersymmetric ones. So these simple systems like the free boson, the compact free boson, and so on, have a surprising amount of physics in them, and you can learn a lot by studying them. Free boson, compact free boson, free fermion, the relations between each other. There is a lot of stuff in there. And, you know, at the office hours, I'm happy to discuss any of these two DCFTs in greater detail.